This is Andre Traversa. Welcome to the second edition of The Cosmic Citizen. With me is my co-host, Paula Thompson. Are you there, Paula?
Yeah, welcome to Blog Talk. I'm sorry I cut off the Blog Talk lady, so I just want to say you're at Blog Talk.
That's okay. We're more important. Anyway, today we have a very distinguished guest for our second edition of The Cosmic Citizen. We're going to, as some of you may know, this is a show that is designed primarily for the spreading of the teachings of the Urantia book, the Urantia Revelation. And we're going to speak today about the foreword to the Urantia book and about part one, which are some of the most complex parts of the book. And to help us do that and to help us get a grasp on some of these complex concepts is Chris Halverson. Chris Halverson is one of the smartest guys I know. He has got a PhD in physics from the University of Colorado in Boulder. He works for the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He has quite a scientific background and can help us, again, with a lot of these complex concepts. He's also just a great student of the book, has been reading it since 1990. Chris, welcome to The Cosmic Citizen.
Thank you. Yeah, great to be here.
Thank you. Now, Chris, let me just start off with the first question. It's not directly related to the foreword or to part one, but let me ask you this. The foreword in part one, especially the foreword, but parts of part one, I mean, this is pretty heady stuff. It's stuff that really takes a lot to wrap your mind around. And I guess what I want to ask you is this. How can the Urantia book ever get widespread acceptance as a revelation when so much of it is so intellectual? I mean, how are the masses ever going to get, you know, to grasp any of this stuff?
Well, I guess the main point there is the revelators created the Urantia book with a very long-term perspective in mind. At several points in the book, they intimate that they were thinking of 1,000 years for the time span of real direct, you know, relevancy of this revelation, you know, in terms of tuning it to our needs, tuning it to where we are moving as a planet, as a people. So it is meant to have a depth and a breadth that can last 1,000 years. So that's the first thing that you have to keep in mind. They're not expecting you to just do a quick once through and have it all wrapped around, you know, your finger. And it's meant to be a lifetime effort for an individual and, you know, a millennial effort for the planet. So
you're saying essentially that our planet will evolve to the point where a lot of these concepts will become much more accessible to people.
Yeah, I mean, many times, you know, it is a revelation, and that revelation of greater understanding is a perspective that you have to evolve your consciousness into. I mean, it took me many, many years of reflection to begin to put the basic structure together in my mind so that when you focus on a specific point in the book, that issue has a place to be hung in a general framework, you know, and you can begin to really appreciate the specifics of what they're trying to say about that point.
Paul, I want you to chime in here, but I want to just go ahead and start asking about the topic that we're going to talk about, which is that the book begins with a foreword. Why do we have the foreword? What's the purpose of the foreword?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that it is called a foreword. It's not called an introduction. And that's very purposeful because it is much more than a mere introduction. I mean, I've got it right in front of me here, and if you read the first sentence, in the minds of the mortals of Urantia, that being the name of your world, there exists great confusion respecting the meaning of such terms as God, divinity, and deity. Okay, with that first sentence, it is sounding a lot like an introduction. And it certainly has some introductory character to it where they're trying to get you have a new and truer starting point for conceiving of concepts like God, divinity, deity, etc. But as you go through the entirety of the foreword, what you really discover that in many ways it is more of a synopsis than it is an introduction. And for me personally, it wasn't until I had finished the entire book, especially once I had read the Supreme Papers, which are towards the end of Part 3, that I could go back and reread the foreword, and it then began to take on a totally different character. It wasn't as impenetrable as I first thought, you know, my first impression of it. Because once you begin to, you know, get this general framework crystallizing in your mind, then you start to really appreciate the incredible succinctness of this synopsis that they've created.
Chris, can I interrupt you? You sound like you're underwater. Is that just me, or?
I don't know.
Andre, do you hear that?
Getting what?
Chris sounds like he's underwater to me. I just want to.
Oh,
make
no,
sure
I don't hear that. No.
Oh, okay, very good.
Probably just another linkage there. Let's see. Anyway, I mean, just that you're beginning to appreciate that when you really want to begin to reflect on the biggest patterns that are about reality that are revealed in the book. There are many passages in the foreword which stand alone relative to any other place in the book in terms of succinctness, you know, pithy clarity of presenting some of those big overarching patterns. I guess maybe one other comment too. If you look at the first paragraphs of the foreword and the last paragraphs of the foreword, within those bookends of the foreword are the two little passages, the little phrases that are the most succinct descriptions of what the purpose of the revelatory papers is. Now, they say that the purpose is to reveal truth and coordinate essential knowledge in order to expand cosmic consciousness and enhance spiritual perception. So those two little phrases, that to reveal truth and the one to expand cosmic consciousness, which are at the end and the beginning, respectively, of that foreword, I haven't run across any other little phrases like that in the entirety of the book that so succinctly sum up precisely what they're about, you know, what their assignment was in constructing the revelation.
Paula, do you have any questions?
Well, I just wanted to clarify. Chris made a comment about revelators, and for people who are listening that may not know what he means by the term revelators, whenever he refers to revelators, he's talking about the authors of the Urantia book. Those of us who read the Urantia book often refer to them as revelators, meaning those who brought the revelation to this world. Anybody familiar with the Urantia book knows that there's no human name anywhere attached to it or anywhere mentioned as an author. All of the authors are celestial beings, and so the general term for the authors is revelators. So I just wanted to clarify.
Very important point. By the way, Paula, your phone is breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you're on a cell phone or what it is, but it's breaking up a little bit on you. I don't know. It's not terrible, but I just want you to know that it's happening.
Yeah, I'm getting the same thing from you.
Huh, well, that's odd. I don't know what that's about. I wonder if our connection is funny. Well, anyway, we're going to have to. This is live radio, folks. We got the. These are the things that happen. Chris, I want to stick with the forward here for at least the first half of the show. So let me ask you. You were saying, one of the things that the book is there, or the forward is there to do is to clarify terms for us, or to redefine terms that we maybe have are confused about, because the book says that there's so much confusion respecting the terms God, divinity, and deity. When the forward uses the word God, what does that mean?
Well, one thing you notice when you look at where they define that term, they don't define it first, because there are concepts that are antecedent to that concept. You start with deity, and they challenge you to let the word symbol deity represent the most generalized, the highest, purest quality of reality, that absolute oneness quality of reality. And there is a reservoir of that quality that is part of the basic construct of all things. And when you draw directly from that reservoir, that essence of oneness, that deity quality, the first source and center as the absolute creator of all things, creates an entity and then bestows personality upon that entity to make that entity a being. That pure, personalized deity is God.
You guys, I need to interrupt you real quick. I hate to do this, but we're getting messages on the board that we're breaking up. So I don't know if we need to call back in or what, but I think it might be a good idea.
Maybe we need to do that. Why don't we take a break, folks? Just a one minute break. We'll reconnect, and let's. That's the only thing I can think of to do, Why don't everybody just hang up and we'll just call back and we'll just call right back and see if we can get a better connection.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Hello. Hello?
Can you hear us?
Yep, gotcha.
Okay, you got us unmuted,
better.
Right?
Sounds better to me.
Okay. Are we on the air now?
Yes, we are.
Okay, great. Sorry, folks, these are the things that we have to deal with live radio. This is not pre-formalized in studio stuff here, and because we had this little glitch, we may go over a little bit. We may go over time a little bit, if that's okay with you, Chris. Maybe 10 or 15 minutes.
Sure.
Because for those of you who know that, if we stop streaming live, don't worry about that. You will be able to download the show, and you will get the show in its entirety, even once the live stream is finished. So we'll go over a little bit. And speaking of phone connections, I want to give out our phone number, which I know is on the screen for you folks, but I want to give it out anyway. 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158, in case anybody wants to call in. Now, we were in the process of doing there. Chris, you were talking to us about God and the book looks at the word God. And you were saying that that God means personalized deity. So does that basically mean that whenever deity manifests personally, that is what the book means when they use the word God?
No. You have to be very precise in your thinking about what they're defining that word symbol to mean. There is only a small handful of individuals who are literally pure, personalized deity. Whenever you have such an individual, it is appropriate to use the term God to describe that personal character, the personal character of that individual. Now, you have other entities, other beings that are extremely high in character, are perfect in every sense of the word that we can comprehend, but they are not God. So, in a sense, what they're doing is trying to get you to begin to reflect on how limited our initial understanding as humans is of the infinity of reality.
Okay, I know someone's going to say, "Well, what are you saying? Are you saying that there are plural gods? Are there many gods? Is that what the book is saying?"
Let's go back to what was that one true essence, true quality of deity? It's oneness, unity. So, even though there may be separate individuations of that oneness, it is an absolute oneness nonetheless. There is no break. For instance, that's why when Jesus was here among us, he could say without any qualification, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." Because Jesus was an incarnate Creator Son. Now, again, the Revelators coined this phrase for a particular type of individual. It's a very high individual, a Creator Son. But he's not just any old individual, like you and I, for instance. He is personalized deity. He is God.
Okay. I want to ask you, Chris, in the book it says, somewhere in part one, it says personality is transmissible. Okay, does that mean that God the Father gave his personality or a huge chunk of his personality or bestowed his personality onto Jesus? Is that what that means?
Yeah. The first source and center initiates all things, when the main aspects of what's being done in creating reality is to divest the center of all things, of all that which can be handed off, can be delegated to other things or other beings. But the core essence of that oneness remains at that center of all things, that reservoir of will. However, the Father can individuate that totality of will. When he individuates will, when he, you know, quote unquote, breaks off and fragments a portion of that, even though it's not a substance, so it's not a literal thought, but when he individuates, when he separates a part of that total will, individuated will is personality. So there's another word which is being very distinctly upstepped in its meaning. No dictionary is going to give you the true meaning of the word personality. That the true meaning is being revealed to us for the first time through the fifth epical revelation. Personality is individuated will. So there is a portion of that will that is separated and bestowed upon the spirit substance of the Creator Son, making that Creator Son a personality.
Okay. Paul, I want to make sure you get some time here to jump in because I don't want to monopolize this whole show. But
I just want to clarify again that for people who may not be familiar with the Urantia book, that the foreword, in my estimation and in most readers' estimation, is the most difficult part of the book because it is just terminology or definitions, as Chris has pointed out, of terms that we're familiar with, but we've never heard them described in quite that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, it's one after another after another, and terms like deity. And I'm sure if you're not familiar with this material, some of the things that Chris has been saying are starting to make your brain hurt. And the foreword can do that. But I would tell people, please understand that the foreword is not indicative of how the rest of the book reads. The foreword is very dense, and there is so much to be discovered within the foreword, but don't get stuck there. Don't say to yourself, I'll never be able to understand this book, because I read the foreword at the age of 20, and I knew that a lot of it was going over my head, but I still read it because I felt it going in on a very deep level. And because I read the foreword, it helped me understand part one of the Urantia book much, much better. And I also want to point out that when Chris made a definition of the first source and center, which I think is one of the most important definitions in the book of God, that God is the first source and center of all things and beings, the first source and center of reality, the causeless cause, the beginning of beginnings. And that concept blows most humans' minds, but you have to get there, and the Urantia book takes you there. So
excellent.
I just wanted to make
excellent,
those.
Paul. Thank you so much for that. You do a great job of synthesizing things, of synthesizing truth. So thank you, thank you. Chris,
I might just make one little augmentation of what she pointed out about her experience that first time she read the foreword, how even though sort of immediately intellectually, it was very dense and hard to wrap her mind around, she could sense that there was a connectivity that she had to it. Why is that? The revelators point out that true epical revelation is evolutional, not revolutional. The more you study the revelation, the more you discover that there's a transcendent art in play in the composition of the book, of the papers, where the revelators, even though they're trying to get you to go way beyond where you're starting, they do so by taking everything that you already have and utilizing it to its maximum, so that they are taking that that initial anchoring that you have in understanding and expanding it. They're not severing you from that foundation. They're stretching that foundation forward. So, yeah, the word personality, in its truest sense, is radically differently conceived in the revelation than it is in the dictionary.
Well, yeah, and I want to ask you about that. And before I do, let me just give out our phone number again, 646-716-8158. Maybe people are just so enraptured by Chris's teaching that they're not calling in, but please feel free. If you have any questions, please call in, 646-716-8158. Chris, I want to ask you, you were just mentioning the definition of terms. The book makes a distinction between soul and personality, which are two words that often a lot of people think of as being the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
How does the book redefine those terms or clarify the meaning of those terms?
You really want to drop back to a little bit more fundamental point and first contrast the clarification of the word self in the revelation to the clarification of the word personality.
Self, you said?
Self.
Okay.
Yeah, it's most fundamentally, it's self and personality that have always been confused in humans' attempts to understand reality and the nature of themselves as an individual. Yourself is that you're not just a collection of molecules. Yes, you have molecules, and yes, those molecules are animated. You are living. But then that living material energy system is augmented by an energy system called mind. And that mind is literal. It's not just the functioning of the brain. It's a literal separate energy system. And that energy system can take on forms. Your relatively unique form of mind, which is predicated on your genetic starting point and then augmented as you go forward by the experiences that you have, the relationships that you develop, that mindal energy system takes on a relatively unique form. That form is called yourself. However, besides mind being added to this energy system, you have an additional higher energy system, spirit energy, spirit substance, which as you move forward in your maturing, begins to become more and more a part of you as an energy phenomenon, this additional energy, spirit energy. That spirit energy can take on a pattern. An absolutely unique pattern, which is bestowed upon you by the first source and center of all things. Like we pointed out, that pattern is your personality. So you have a pattern in that spirit energy, that unity-like energy, and then you have a form in your mindal energy, which is the energy which relates your material energy to that spirit energy. It's this associative energy system. It allows your molecules to have an evolving, progressing relationship with God.
Hmm.
It connects you to higher things. So those are two separate energy systems, and so they have initially two separate forms. So that mindal form is yourself, and that spirit pattern is your personality. And what you are attempting to do as you progress in the universe is to more and more make that mindal form, make yourself shaped like the divine pattern, like the personality that God has given you. And one of the most important initial steps in that process is to create a copy, if you will, a higher expression of that self in a substance that won't die when your material energy system dies, so that yourself can go on, that form can go on and continue to identify with personality, with godlikeness. And that copy, that immortal, potentially immortal self, is your soul.
Yeah, and I want to stop there for a second, because one thing I want to clarify too, for listeners and for those who are unfamiliar with the book, one of the things that makes the Urantia book interesting and unique is that, unlike in a lot of other faiths, the soul is not inherently immortal. We need to make certain decisions in order to ensure immortality, so to speak. Is that correct?
It doesn't even inherently exist.
That's true. Yes, that's true. We create it. Yes.
Yeah. You're given all of the gifts, you know, by grace that you need to do that, but you must choose to do that. Eternity is not automatic. It's a choice.
Yes.
Just a time check, guys. We're 28 minutes remaining.
Okay. Why don't we switch gears a little bit go to part one? The part one is called The Central and Super Universes. Now, let me just go ahead and ask you this. What does the book mean when it talks about the central universe? What is the central universe?
That question exists in a much larger question of that the Revelator's approach for us, trying to get us to expand our concept of the place that we exist in. that it's not only personality and beings that have a divine center and hence an absolute over, ultimate absolute over control to them, but things, the actual cosmos, the universe does also have this center to it. And because God is the first source and center of that thingness of reality as well, that gets immediately expressed on the largest scales of the entire material universe. All the millions and billions of galaxies have a symmetry to them in the whole, which has a center to it. It's on a scale that's so large that current astronomers have not yet begun to fully appreciate this, but they eventually will. They are beginning to get the first senses of it, even though they haven't realized it. That all of the millions of galaxies actually are all centered about a focus in this material structure, a central universe, a central material domain about which everything is symmetric. And that, so there is a central core to this, what's called the master universe, this whole of material reality. And that central universe is a perfect domain. It is not an evolutionary domain. It's the pattern for us, for the evolving part of the material domain. What are we evolving towards? What is our material goal as a cosmos? It is that central pattern, that central universe. Our planet, in our solar system, in our Milky Way galaxy, that whole material system is evolving over trillions of years of time toward that central pattern, with vast numbers of material ministry, material over-control beings who are guiding that evolution towards that central pattern. So that's maybe the first thing that we could say.
I love to think of paradise as the hub, the nuclear hub of all creation. And, of course, it's the center where the first source and center is, and it sits outside of time and space. The cosmology of the Urantia book I find to be absolutely astonishing and fascinating, the story of the seven super universes and each one with a trillion inhabitable worlds. So I would really, you know, and I know that the Urantia book, the first part, the first five papers, for instance, the most beautiful papers, the most beautiful writings on earth about God, the nature of God, his loving and perfect nature. So I hope you will touch on that, Chris, a little bit about God and also about the cosmology, just the basic cosmology of the book.
Yeah, and maybe just a point kind of tying into what you were just referring to. It's interesting to note just how the Revelators choose to put together the first sequence of papers in part one. We all know that one of the core touchstones in human history for the nature of God and even for cosmology, if you can call it that from its ignorant perspective, that humans have had. But, you know, that touchstone is the Old Testament. And that Old Testament begins with five books, which are called the Pentateuch.
Right.
And for, say, when you go back to Jesus' time, the Sadducees, for them, the real nuclear purists of the Jewish belief system, they really only held those first five books, the Pentateuch, as canonical. What do the Revelators do with that idea that we have
wait, I'm going to stop you, Chris. Let's see if I get this straight. This is really fascinating. I've never heard anybody do what you're doing. You're relating the first five. What you're saying is that in a sense, they do. Are you convinced that the revelators actually deliberately made
yes.
papers five as a kind of as being analogous to the first five books of the Old Testament?
Yeah, those first.
You really do. That's very. What is your? I'm curious because that's. Some people are going to listen and say, "Well, that's speculation." Do you have any kind of evidence or reason for that conclusion?
So hold that thought for a minute, you guys, because we have a caller. Can we take
okay.
a caller?
Sure.
On the line, I've been enjoying the show. I'd be interested to hear what your guests have to say about the Urantia Book's view of gravity and how it relates to modern science as we understand or don't understand gravity.
Hi, 614, you're on Blog Talk. What's your name?
Yeah, my name is Scott.
Hi, Scott.
Yeah,
is that Scott? Hey, is that Scott Brooks?
Yeah, it is, yes.
Hey, Scott, this is Andre Traversa. I think you remember me. I met you at a conference about a year ago.
Indeed.
Yes. Well, go ahead, Chris, and let's give Scott an earful here. What about gravity and what the Urantia Book says about gravity and how it relates to modern science?
Yeah,
I'll take the call offline. Thanks.
There is many things that can be said because there is an extensive revelation of physical reality in the Urantia Book, but perhaps the fundamental kernel that you can begin to reflect on in terms of their revelatory tweaking of our thinking about gravity is they're very pointed about talking about gravity in a twofold fashion, where they speak of local linear gravity, which is what we call gravity, that Newtonian gravity, that relationship between two masses separated by a given distance. That local linear gravity, as Revelators point out, is a consequence. It's in a sense a downstepped expression of a higher gravitational fact, absolute gravity. At the center of all things, the nuclear isle of paradise, is a material construct. It is an absolute material nucleus, and it is the focus of an absolute gravity. As Paula pointed out earlier, you must remember, though, that nuclear isle, as an absolute fact, is outside of finite space and time. And so that absolute gravity of the Isle of Paradise is imposed upon finite space and time, not in a linear, finite, relational sense, because it transcends that finite relationship. It manifests in finite space and time as a presence, a universal presence. And if you think about when we try to describe local linear gravity, Newtonian gravity, in order to calculate the gravitational force between two objects, you not only need to know the distance separating them, but you need to know this mysterious quantity called the mass of that object, of the two objects involved. What is the mass? Scientists are still trying to understand what mass is. The thing you can notice, first of all, about mass is that it is a scalar quantity, not a vector quantity. It's not a function of space or time. It doesn't have a direction. It's just a number. 5 kilograms, and it's 5 kilograms today, and it's 5 kilograms tomorrow. It's 5 kilograms in Boulder. It's 5 kilograms in Chicago. It's just a scalar quantity. Why? What would give something a characteristic that's transfinite? Because by definition, all finite things must be a function of space or time. They must be relative. The mass is not relative. Why? The reason why is that is the footprint of the absolute gravity of the Isle of Paradise, which is not a function of space or time, is not relative, it's absolute gravity. maybe just leave it at that point as a as an initial tweak to begin to reflect on this bigger picture that they're trying to bring into play. And fundamentally what they try to do in so many cases about the physical universe is they're trying to get us to notice that not everything in our physical perspective is a finite quantity. Some of these things are not relative, like the speed of light is not relative, the mass is not relative, etc. Why is there this universality imposed upon the finite domain? The only way that that can be is that there's something that's transfinite.
Chris,
hey,
I want to thank you. Go ahead, I'm sorry,
before
Paul.
Before you switch, we have a somebody on the chat room that would love for you to continue to address your point that you were making about the Old Testament books,
yeah.
The first five books of the
Old
Testament.
Yeah, and I'm glad someone's doing that, because I want to sort of build on that and ask you, Chris, what evidence do you have for your conclusion? Someone's going to say that's speculation, that the first five papers are analogous to the first five books of the Old Testament. What drew you to that conclusion?
Well, the way that works is over a long span of time of reflecting more and more on the character of the revelation, the more you begin to directly experience that it's what they say it is. It's very much an evolutional phenomenon. You can take note of the direct statements in the book that they are told as part of the revelatory mandate that if there is anything, any concept or any expression of a concept that we have that can be used with, quote, more or less distortion of meaning, they must do that before they truly, jump ahead of where we are and give us revelation that doesn't have a lot of pretext to it. They must use our pretext. The Pentateuch in the Bible is a very definitive pretext that we have. So what they're...
it's kind of a foundational thing. Is that
right.
What you're saying?
You begin to realize that when you find these patterns are not a coincidence. These patterns are purposed by the revelators, if for no other reason, because of the revelatory mandate, telling them that they must try to tie into our patterns. So they're saying, okay, you have a Pentateuch. Let's give you a new Pentateuch. Let's give you five papers that give you a full revelation of the nature of God and the relationship of that God to the universe and the relationship of that God to you as an individual. But it doesn't stop there. If you start looking a little more closely, not only do they give you one Pentateuch, they give you a triune Pentateuch, because you have the first set of five papers about that fundamental nature of God. Then you have a second five papers, two on the nature of the eternal Son, two on the nature of the infinite Spirit, the other two absolute infinite personalities of the Trinity, and then a paper on the Trinity itself. That creates a second set of five papers. And then there's a third set of five papers on the cosmology, starting with the nuclear Isle of Paradise and then giving you and then expanding outward to the bigger picture of the entire master universe. So there's actually three Pentateuchs. It's not a coincidence. This is very purposeful.
Wow.
Hey, Chris, can you define Pentateuch for us that are...
Five books. It literally means five books.
Five books, okay.
Penta, is five. Pentateuch is five books.
Yeah, it's like the word penta, like pentagram, five-pointed star.
Right.
The same thing.
Okay.
So, wow, that's really interesting. We were going to...
Maybe just one more thing before... Sure. I'll just point out, because it's a fundamental... This sort of seeking these patterns... That's a key to unlocking your relationship with the revelation. The revelation is magnificent in its precise construct of these master patterns of reality. And they're woven through every sentence of the entire book. in this masterful fashion. The more you can begin to seek out and create a relationship with those overarching patterns of reality and hence of the revelation, the more you will get yourself out of the stasis that you may be experiencing in your relationship with the revelation.
Mm.
It will become alive for you.
Are these? I know we're switching gears, but I don't want us to be. I want this to be spirit led. I don't want us to stick to a rigid set pattern. So let me ask you something, Chris. These patterns that you're talking about, like the fivefold patterns you mentioned, okay, and other patterns, is that one of the things that you think is evidence for you or build a case for you that this really is a revelation and this is not just some book that was created by a bunch of humans?
Well, certainly, in a very rudimentary level, the more you carefully reflect on just the basic construct of the book, the harder it gets to sustain what really ought to be your initial assumption. You first find this book, I mean, you shouldn't be leaping off to some wild conclusion about it. You're probably going to say, well, it must be some book written by some guy or some group of guys a while back, and maybe it's interesting, I'll check it out. But the more you read it, the more you start reflecting on it, the more you realize that assumption is not very likely. It has this incredible consistency and precision to it. You can do an electronic search of a given word in the, and how that noun, say, is used in the book. Maybe it's used 60 times. And you carefully examine it. And it's always used in precisely the same fashion, despite the fact that you have many different authors, using that. There is this amazing quality to it where it's like, well, if this was written by a group of guys, that's really hard to imagine how you got them to be so self-consistent like that. Even if it was written by a single individual, how does he have this incredible clarity that no one else has ever demonstrated for using language with such transcendent precision? So, there are many sort of basic things like that will begin to eat away at your initial skepticism or at least critical perspective. I mean, when I found the book, the first thing I said to myself, I dare it to be logical.
I'm sorry, say that again. When you first found the book, you what?
One of the first things I said, I was curious about reading it, but I said, I dare it to be logical.
Ah. Now, that's interesting. Go ahead, I'm sorry. Were you going to say something, Paula?
Well, I just wanted to share something because, Chris points out the symmetry and the replete, consistent nature of the book and its teachings. And since we're talking about part one, I just wanted to read a quote from paper two, The Nature of God, which really, the Urantia book hones in on the goodness of God and the perfection of God, the love of God, the majesty of God, the benevolence of God. I mean, I often tell people, it's the God of my dreams, the God that I could easily fall on my face and worship. He is so good, so perfect. And the author of Paper 2, The Nature of God, says this, and I find it so beautiful and touching. He says, I find it easy and pleasant to worship one who is so great and at the same time so affectionately devoted to the uplifting ministry of his lowly creatures. I naturally love one who is so powerful in creation and in the control thereof, and yet who is so perfect in goodness and so faithful in the loving kindness which constantly overshadows us. I think I would love God just as much if he were not so great and powerful, as long as he is so good and merciful. We all love God. We all love the Father more because of his nature than in recognition of his amazing attributes. So characterized throughout these papers about the power and the majesty of the first source and center is this love of the Creator that comes through the authors. They love their Creator so much, and this love that they feel for God is infectious. And you just can't help, as you read their words like what I just read, and say, oh, this is God. This is the God that we don't know, that we've never been given before. It's been the God of wrath or the God of judgment. But this is ultimately the God of love, God the Father. And so it's so exquisite that way.
But you know what, Paula, you know what's interesting about what you're saying, Paula, though, is that you say that that's not the God we've been given. We've been given a God of wrath or a God of judgment. Although, thankfully, because of the teachings of Jesus and because of some Old Testament passages, especially by the later prophets, we have had enough of that teaching within our major religions, particularly Christianity, that people have it's been mixed in with the wrath of God and the judgment of God. That I think what's happened is people have had contradictory pictures of who God is. You know, they hear on the one hand that he's loving and kind and merciful, then they hear he's wrathful and judgmental. So that's one reason for the book is to clear up that confusion. But I just have to say that, you know, I have a very conservative Christian background, and one of the things that got me back into the Urantia book, I was away from it for about 10 years. One of the things that got me back into it was I was going through a very difficult time. I won't get into it right now, but I was going through basically an 18-month depression back in 2003 and sought therapy with a Christian counselor, in fact. And I was engaging in times of intense, deep prayer. And God would speak to my heart and show me how much he loves me and how much he cares for me. And then I would hear things in church about how, you know, how God is you know, terrible and angry and all. And I knew that wasn't the God that I knew. That wasn't the God that I experienced. So on the one hand, you're right. There's a lot that the book is trying to clear up for us because of shortcomings in our teaching. But on the other hand, I think that for any of us who've really experienced God, I think we have to know that God can't be angry. God can't be. God has got to be more loving than we are.
I was just going to say, you also discover that, you know, or you should begin to discover that God is defined by your relationship within you, not by others.
That's right.
You know, you have been given free gifts, you know, divine gifts by grace that allow you to connect to God. And you will begin to discover that the center of all things is an absolute loving person. The love that God has, the universal Father has for you, is not the finite love that so many people preach, where it's relative to what you do or who you are or where you live or what you've done.
What you say, what you believe.
It's an absolute love. You must know that. You know, absolutely. That God loves you absolutely. God loves you as if you're the only person in all of reality.
And God loves me regardless of the choices I make. Now, we are hopefully going to make, you know, better choices. But if I make stupid choices, God is still going to love me.
The only choice that you can make that alters your relationship to God is an absolute choice. If you absolutely choose to absolutely not be part of reality, then God can't love you because you don't exist.
Right. But that's something that I would do, not something God would do.
Right.
And the other thing is, if I were to do something that insane, but I mean, and the book calls that cosmic insanity, by the way. But I guess what I was saying about God is, I believe that when people make choices like that, because some people do, that God is grieved by that. I really believe, because God's heart is one of love. He wants to love every one of his creation. So I believe that when someone makes a choice like that, God is in a sense heartbroken, saddened. You know, do you think it's? I don't know. Maybe I'm anthropomorphizing or using too many human emotions. But the point I'm trying to make is that I don't think that God takes any pleasure. And even the Bible says God does not take pleasure in the death of the wicked. So I don't believe God takes any pleasure or righteous anger or anything like that when people make a choice like the choice to reject him eternally.
I absolutely agree with that, Andre. And my favorite quote, a quote that I tell people all the time, is the one that says, the love of the Father absolutely individualizes each personality as a unique child of the universal Father, a child without duplicate in infinity. a will creature irreplaceable in eternity. I mean, if that doesn't tell you how meaningful your existence is in God's eyes, nothing will, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a facet of the Universal Father that is for you and you alone. Not even the Eternal Son in all of his infinity and absoluteness touches that facet of the Father.
That's
there is
beautiful.
A facet of the Father that is for you, your personality, and your personality alone. You know? And that's how absolutely he loves you. And he sets aside a part of himself only for you.
Well, let me, and by the way, how much, are we gone over time yet, Paula?
I have a minute, and I should probably
okay.
play the disclaimer, and then we can continue on.
Okay, we have a minute. Let's let people know. No, we don't need to play the disclaimer. We can play the disclaimer at the end of the at the end of our actual show. What we can say to people though is, as we are going to stop streaming in a little under a minute here. But for any of you who want to download the show, the download should be available in a couple of hours or an hour and a half or something like that. I can't remember exactly what the time frame is, but we are going to continue. The entire recording will the entire show will be recorded on download. So. We will not be streaming shortly, but after the streaming stops, it will still be available later on for download. And with that in mind, let me go ahead and since we're talking about the love of God, Chris,
mm-hmm.
let me ask you, how is the love of God, part one demonstrates some pretty incredible ways in which God loves us. How does he demonstrate that love?
One of the ways he demonstrates that so literally is you can see just as you begin to scan through the titles of the remaining papers in part one. Once you get past that threefold Pentateuch at the beginning that gives you the biggest picture of things, then it moves into a whole series of papers that go into this exhaustive revelation of the well-nigh infinite number of children of the three absolute persons who have been created to minister to all of reality. Many of those beings are made to minister solely to you in your ascension career. There's a whole hierarchy of angels, of angelic-like beings that are there to be an intimate spiritual minister with you as you move all the way up through this long ascension journey, starting from this benighted sphere and culminating on the Isle of Paradise. There is not one gap in the personal ministry throughout the entirety of this vast cosmos. No matter where you go, there is the hand of God. That's how much he loves you. Just try to go somewhere where he isn't. People who get into that mode, like you mentioned, a depression mode, where they start to feel like they're in a bubble, disconnected from love. No, you're not. You are intimately loved.
Oftentimes
the presence of God permeates every square inch of the room that you're in.
I love it when you're on this road, Chris, and I just wanted to say that you have oftentimes told me this notion of God being the vast infinite plane rather than the knife edge. Would you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah. One of the names that you can give to that first source and center is the infinite upholder. And words like infinite and absolute need to be reflected on deeply. You need to recognize what that really means. Infinity has consequences. Infinity is a big concept. It's infinitely big. There, when you say that God is the infinite upholder, you're not just using a superlative because you're really desperately hoping that somehow you don't fall through a crack somewhere in reality. That's not what you mean by the word infinite. The word infinite is not wishful thinking. The word infinite is a fact. It is a fact. that you exist on an infinite, immutable plane. Nothing can break it. Nothing can, you know, tilt it. You know, there's an infinite stability, an infinite upholding of all of reality. You cannot fall. By all appearances of the contrary, you must know that you cannot truly fall. There is no bottomless pit in the universe. Okay? That's a myth. That's a delusion. That's fear speaking. Okay? The only thing that you can do is to not exist.
And let's be clear about that. There's people who, it is possible to reject God, but you have to work hard at it.
Right.
You know,
you have to work absolutely at it.
Yeah,
it's not just, well, you know, one time I purposely chose that which I knew to be bad, wrong, evil. I sinned.
Even people who think they're atheists are not necessarily rejecting God. I mean, I think my dad thought he was an atheist, but I don't believe he really rejected God. He just rejected a lot of the theories.
All you have to do is look at him, and you can tell. I mean, is he iniquitous? Is absolutely every single choice and action that he manifests an absolutely conscious choice of evil? You know, is he systemically empty? No.
I think atheism is really people rejecting religions, not God.
Right.
I think if anybody ever said
that. Atheists, by and large, are rejecting immature notions of God.
Yes, exactly.
And my question is always, okay, so you have enough wisdom, or maybe I shouldn't call it wisdom, enough intelligence at least, to recognize an immature notion of God, which you can tell is illogical. Okay, what about the real God now?
Yeah.
Right.
You have to be able to separate God from religions. You just have to, because religions are just our human way of trying to answer questions about God that seem inanswerable, but they are not God. Those answers we come up with are not necessarily God.
They're
just
misunderstandings of God most of the time. You know?
They're what, Chris?
They're misunderstandings of God most of the time.
Exactly.
You have to get to the point where you recognize that ignorance does not define reality. I mean, and this response, you know, if you say, well, what about the real God? And they say, well, there is no God. It's like, okay, so let me understand what your line of reasoning here. You're saying that if you take a three-year-old child and they're ignorant of calculus, that means that calculus doesn't exist.
That's a great analogy.
It's like, yeah. No, that's not the way it works. I mean, the universe could care less about your ignorance. It just is.
Yes.
God is.
Yes. And let me also say two things. This is kind of a part that's later on in part four, I think, but it says, God responds to the faintest flicker of faith that someone has. So even if someone, you know, claims to be an atheist, you know, as I said, if they have even a little bit of faith in their heart, you know, or desire for something bigger, you know, the universe is going to respond to that. God's going to respond to that. The other thing, there's a place too in part three where it says they would the revelators would rather they'd rather risk a system wide rebellion than that one soul be lost. So they do everything in their power to you know ensure or to provide, I should say, for the survival of every person. Now, you know, free will still reigns, so some people are still going to do that. They're still going to reject God, but that's, you know, that's in a sense over the father's dead body. I'm using a terribly crude analogy, but you know
what's the fact behind that? They would sooner resist allow a system rebellion than not allow each individual the fullest opportunity to choose eternity. You know, why is that in play? Well, the beings that are making those initial accommodations of your ascension career are lowly, finite beings, not that much above you, you and I. And their vision is not absolute. There are beings, the ancients of days, who have an ultimate microscope that can zoom in and find the tiniest little nano flicker of faith. But the lower beings that are initially providing the place for you to ascend and grow are not the Ancients of Days. They're not beings with that ultimate microscope. They're saying, well, I don't see anything, but it just could be my smallness of vision. Let's allow this to go forward, the truth will bear out as to whether or not there really is something there. Because nothing of value is ever lost. Value is eternal. It will come through if it's there.
So what you're saying essentially is that even these finite beings, if these finite beings are saying that mercy dominates the process, then how much more would the absolute beings view it, even more deeply? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Right. There is an absolute source of mercy, and that's why nothing of value is ever lost. If there wasn't an absolute source of mercy, things occasionally would slip through the cracks. Someone would miss something. Someone would not give something a full opportunity. Someone would cut something short that shouldn't have been cut short.
Mm.
It never happens.
Wow.
Because everything has an absolute source behind it. So there is no, gap. There is no possibility of error. Nothing of value is ever lost.
I want to, since we don't have too much time, I think they only give us a half hour extra. So I want to just make sure we touch on what you were talking about, Paula, which is the cosmology of the Urantia book. You were talking about what the central universe was. We didn't really get a chance to talk about Havona. What is Havona?
Well, that is the central universe.
Okay, but what is that? What is it exactly?
By and large, that is the central universe. I mean, when you speak of the central universe, you not only have Havona, which is a billion perfect worlds that are organized, maybe I should say, about the center of all things, that center of symmetry, that Isle of Paradise, nucleus of all things. Then there are also 21 special worlds, three sets of seven. Seven for the Father, seven for the Eternal Son, seven for the Infinite Spirit. So the totality of the central universe is those billion worlds, those 21 special spheres, and then the nuclear Isle of Paradise. In terms of your ascension career, you begin out here in the very much finite domain of our super universe, the Milky Way galaxy and its immediate environs. You work your way up through that. You eventually reach a level of growth of internal nature that allows you to take that next step, to begin to move up out of the merely finite, a merely finite relationship with reality. And you are transported to that central domain. And you begin what you could kind of think of, if you think of a plane being the finite, and let the third dimension be beginning to transcend that finite. As you move into that central universe, you begin a spiral ascent that moves upward, that begins to transcend the finite more and more, but also moves inward towards the center of all things. When you get to the final world of that inner upward spiral journey within Havona, those billion worlds, you can then take that last step, make that last journey from that highest world to the highest point of all things, the center of all things. And you actually can land on the Isle of Paradise and have a relationship with the absoluteness of that isle. You can stand in the intimate presence of the three absolute persons. That's your goal. But you can't have a relationship with such absoluteness of spirit and personality end, you must evolve upward slowly and surely over a long span of time until you are something that can relate to the center of all things, as opposed to something that yearns to relate to the center of all things. So you are slowly translating that faith leap into a fact of true relationship with the absolute center of all things.
Bruce, would you say that in that journey, there's always the battle of overcoming doubt?
Well, you have an initial battle of overcoming doubt. And when you finally reach that point, which happens relatively early on in your ascension, when you have, without reservation, made an absolute choice of eternity, the moment that any true doubt is purged, that moment you fuse with the Father fragment within you, the anchor point that God has put within your mind, that spirit fragment, you fuse with it. And the spirit gravity, which emanates from the center of all things, locks onto you and begins to draw you in towards that center. So at that point, there is no longer any true doubt. You know with absolute surety that there is an absolute center, and you absolutely choose to be a part of it in eternity. And you fuse at that point with your adjuster. And that happens most of the time while you're still in this immediate domain of the galaxy, this immediate local system of solar systems. While you're on the mansion world, most of the time before you even get to the headquarters of the local system, to Jerusalem. So it happens early on that you can make that absolute choice to put true doubt aside. In Jesus' great affirmation, I am absolutely confident, in my Heavenly Father's overcare. He's stating that because at that point he has fused. Fused with his Michael.
The journey of eternity. I mean, eternity is a long, long time, and certainly people, beings who are ascending like us, we are ascending beings. And you touched on a concept that is purely revelatory, as I understand it, and that is the concept of spirit gravity.
Yeah.
We're very aware of physical gravity holds our body to this planet, but I don't know of anywhere, any other book that has ever mentioned the reality of spirit gravity that pulls our spirit ever upwards and inwards towards the center of all things. But in that journey, what propels us along is our desire to go, our free will, choice to keep going. And so it's important to note that eternity is a long time, and that up until that point of the irrevocable decision that you just mentioned, that decision to be one with the Heavenly Father forever, you can choose not to.
Yes.
And that is the ultimate free will choice. Your free will would mean nothing if you couldn't make that choice.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things I love about the Urantia revelation is that just how much the universe respects our free will. That our free, in a sense, God is so humble that He gives us the last word.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And that ties back to your earlier question about what's the difference between self and personality. In terms of this choosing, yourself can assert itself. There is self-assertion, but you don't want to confuse that self-assertion with free will, true free will, which is a personality phenomenon, a spirit substance-related choice, not a mindal energy-related choice. The little child who's digging in his heels and holding onto his mom's pant legs and screaming at the top of his lungs in the mall because he doesn't want to leave the toy store is not exercising free will. It's exercising self-assertion.
Okay.
Free will, true free will, is a godlikeness. That screaming, selfish little
who does choose to reject God, are they exercising free will or self-assertion?
Well, they are. I mean, if they truly are rejecting, absolutely rejecting God, they are by definition exercising free will. You only have free will, absolutely, in one sense. You can choose eternity.
Right. Well, I would say that I would argue that right now our free will is relative because it's
right.
conditioned by antecedent causation and all the rest of that stuff.
But
correct me if I'm wrong. As we ascend through our universe career, doesn't our free will become more and more? Don't we become more and more free? And even though right now the only absolutely free choice we can make is to choose eternity, but the book also says, in part three at least, that the inner life is the only part of us that's totally free and creative. So I mean, I think we can get glimpses here of absolute free will.
Yeah, I mean, don't misunderstand me. I'm talking about as you begin here.
Yeah.
Your personality has seven dimensions, three finite dimensions, three transfinite, that is, absonite dimensions, and one absolute dimension. And there's free will in all those dimensions. But initially, the only choice that you have in that regard is through that absolute dimension to absolutely choose to be part of the one reality with God at its center.
Mm.
When you get to paradise and you've perfected your finite dimensionality, when you're perfect, even as the Father in heaven is perfect in regards to your finite dimensionality, then you can begin to make free will choices relative to that finite perfection. Those choices like to give rise, through relationships with other finaliters or with Havona natives to actual, beings that are manifested as a literal expression of that perfect choice. But that's a long ways off.
Yeah, that's a very long ways off.
Initially, all you have is the choice of eternity. And all your other things, all those other self-assertions can be overruled by the vicissitudes or, by some individual's evil intent,
Chris, I don't think those I think those self-assertions are as meaningless to the Heavenly Father as they are to any loving parent who just looks at it as a blip on the road of child growth and development and is completely mindful of the various stages that any evolving child goes through. And I think that's such an important concept that the Urantia book points out, that it is not so important who you are as who you are becoming,
right.
and that your direction is pointed in the right way. The Heavenly Father just wants you to point yourself in the right direction and keep moving forward. The little mistakes you make, it's like Jesus says, the mistakes you fail to make to forget in time will be forgotten in eternity. We have eternity to work out this perfection thing. We don't have to be so hard on ourselves,
absolutely.
And we don't have to be so hard on each other.
That's exactly right. See, and this is so important because one of the things I was dealing with when I was depressed was that it was a really perfectionistic tendency. And I think it's very easy for us as readers, if we were not careful, to look at the Urantia book, which talks about striving for perfection, and think, "Oh, I've got to be on this treadmill for God. I've got to do more." And that's not what this is about. In fact, there's a place in part one. I wish I knew where it was. Maybe you know where it is, Paula, where it says that the universe, the watchword of the universe is going to be, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in little things. I will make you ruler over universe realities." And there's a part in there where it says something about how the perfection that we eventually have is not going to be one based on achievement or something. I can't remember how they put it, but I'll have to find it and maybe share it with the audience another time. But it's just a really gracious statement.
Yeah, maybe one point of an overarching component of the revelation that this ties to. As people discover the revelation and begin to read it and try to understand it, what you want to first challenge yourself is to move out of You know, it's not what you are, but what you're becoming. You've got to move away from a fact-finder consciousness. A fact-finder consciousness, you know, judges you by what you are, not by what you're becoming.
Oh,
that's a truth-seeker consciousness judges, you know, by what you're becoming. And it relates to the whole of reality in a similar, dynamic, patient fashion, you know. Seek, you know, the truth in the revelation first. You know, seek first the kingdom of heaven. You want to seek the truth. It's like as you're reading through the foreword, like you were pointing out, Paula, as a set of facts, it's initially, you know, essentially impenetrable. But the truth is not impenetrable. Seek the truth that's even there. The purpose of the revelation is to reveal truth, and every sentence does that. Even if initially you don't see that, seek it. It's there. Find
Andre,
the truth.
Here's your quote, Andre. And when man's ascending soul stands before the supreme judge, the decision of eternal import will not be determined by material successes or quantitative achievements.
Wow.
The verdict, reverberating through the high courts, declares, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few essentials. You shall be made ruler over universe reality."
That is so, I cannot tell you how it's more than refreshing, how liberating that quote is, because it's not about, you know, if I make a mistake, or it's not about, the perfection is not a perfection of action, or it doesn't mean I have to do everything right. I don't think that's what they're talking about here. What do you think they're talking about here, Chris, when they talk about perfection? Because that's a great quote. I mean, to me, that just settles every neurotic perfectionistic thought I've ever had.
It drops right back to one of the first things you asked me when we were initially talking about the foreword, and that word deity. You know, what is this attribute associated with deity? Is it a quantity of some sort? No, it's a quality.
Okay.
You have God-likeness via quality, not quantity. It's not how big you are. It's not how vast your mind is.
Wow.
It's the character of your quality. Is it deity-like? Is it God-like? Does it have that essence of unity with all things? If it does,
then you
will be part of all things, by definition.
That reminds me of Jesus saying that that we will know each other by our fruits. And, you know, we were talking about atheism. Once again, it's not about what you believe or what you don't believe. It's about your fruits, and that is about your quality, I think, Chris. It's what you just said, that if Jesus told us that we will know each other by our fruits, then certainly God knows us by our fruits.
That's right.
We are known throughout the universe of universes by our fruits. That is the way we are known, is what we produce, the quality that comes out of us.
Yes.
And
God
judges
that, you know, professed atheist, not by, you know, the factual ignorance that he, you know, professes.
Yes.
You know, he looks at the quality that's there in spite of that factual.
Absolutely. And we probably are going to have to go here soon, because I think they're going to probably bump
us off.
Yeah,
we have 5 minutes, guys, according to my clock. So.
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes?
Well,
okay.
It's 11:25 here.
Okay.
In
okay, that's fine. I want to just ask you one last question before we close,
mm-hmm.
and that is this, Chris. Why did God initiate this supreme mandate? Be you perfect, even as I am perfect. Why does He want us to become like Himself?
This ties to the fundamental question of why anything is. If in the beginning was the I Am, and the I Am was infinite, you know, total, perfectly symmetric, why aren't we done with our first thought? Why isn't there just the I Am of all things? It's because there's one thing, and one thing only, that's missing. missing from that infinite, perfect symmetry, true relationship.
Mm.
The I am is singular. It's a singularity. It isn't truly everything. It's missing that one fundamental element, true relationship. So the purpose of all of reality is to create the infinity of true relationship.
Wow.
Which takes an infinite number of truly separated parts and an eternity to truly harmonize them. You know, in an infinity of perfect relationship.
Mm-hmm. Which is embraceable and knowable and lovable. And
yeah, I mean, it is the key. And when you think about the description of the beginning of all things that they give you in the Revelation, the very first act by the first source and center, the actor, is to create that relationship, you know, that fundamental foundation of relationship potential, to separate unity and individuality from each other, and then launch the infinity of eternity that will harmonize that infinite individuality to that absolute unity. That's what reality is all about.
It's
that's
not
why
unlike
all
it's not unlike
after what left. Go ahead, Paul, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just gonna say it's not unlike the cell dividing. And that ends up in being a human being, a miraculous thing.
Right. I mean, there's a whole huge collection of individuations which seemingly miraculously works together, you know, in harmony. No, there's no miracle there. That's called spirit energy, you know, in identification with that material individuality. Individuality doesn't magically join together in harmony. It is brought into relationship with the essence of unity, spirit energy, and begins to take on that quality of oneness. And a big part of the revelation is to lay out that whole picture so you can understand literally how that can be.
Mm-hmm. You guys, we're going to probably have to come to a close here. Chris, I want to thank you again so much for being on our show. This has been a great show. And Paula, you've done a fantastic job of just really just providing all kinds of just incredible information. I just love the way you're just kind of digging around in the book there while we're talking, getting up the right quotes. You're just doing a great job. So thank you so much.
Andre, and thank you, Chris. You're awesome as always.
And most welcome.
Chris, thank you again for just, and it doesn't matter that we went off track. This, as I said, this is a spirit-led program, so I thank you for that. Folks, tune in again next week at 11 a.m. Central Time. For a next show we're going to have with Michelle Clemens. She's going to talk about part two of the Urantia book. And thank you again for listening to The Cosmic Citizen, and just thank you for all your calls, your messages, everything, and we look forward to seeing you next week.